David here. It's nearly midnight, June 16th, 2020. Nearly bedtime. Story time, really. Spent a good part of the day getting the Kensington virtual tour ready. I'm presenting it on Thursday. And I hit on the idea of having the designer produce a PDF of the Kensington chapter in the London Walks book. I wrote that chapter, and I thought, I'm going to give that to the people on the tour, just as a little going-away present, as it were. Anyway, that got me thinking about London Stories, the London Walks book. It was published all of 11 years ago, 2009, and we were after something different with the book. We didn't want to write a bog-standard guidebook. You know the kind of thing I mean. Come out of the tube, turn left, go 25 yards, turn right at the Starbucks. I mean, that kind of prose, that's a cure for happiness. We wanted something that was a good read, an armchair read, an accompaniment to the walks, rather than a transcription of a walking tour route. And I think the book has really stood up. It's still very much in print. But anyway, remembering, thinking about it, I thought about the introduction, which is one of the chapters that I wrote, and then that long first chapter on the Thames, and just, you know, how lucky I was with at one point in the writing of that chapter. It was like playing the slots, putting the coin in, pulling the lever, and 25 billion bricks came out. But I thought tonight, since it's story time, I'd maybe read the first dozen or so paragraphs of that opening, just a paragraph or two from the tail end of the introduction. And then, yeah, that first big chapter called Themesis, which is about London and the Thames. Anyway, it goes like this. London Stories is a different kind of guidebook. Some of the information is well known, the landmarks and signposts along the road of London's history. But there is much that will be new to readers. And, of course, it's all in the telling, which is what London Walks guides do best. London for me, and for my London Walks colleagues, is an enchanted forest. It's full of wondrous, strange music and echoes, past and present. In short, my London is also Chaucer's London, and Shakespeare's London, and Donne's London, and Pepys's London, and Dickens's London, and Boudicca's London, and Mrs. Pankhurst's London, and Churchill's London, and John Lennon's London, and so on. And that's the London, those are the Londons, that we explore on our walks, and in these pages. Okay, chapter one, Themesis. The best way to see London is to hear it. The Thames, Londinium, Londonwick, Londonburg, Thames Street, Fleet Street, the Strand, Shipwright's Lane, Holborn, Strand Bridge, Queenhithe, Paul's Wharf, Bankside, Walbrook, Millbank, Horse Ferry, Chelsea, Putney, Stepney, Hackney, Battersea, Bermondsey, Thorney, Eastbourne, Westbourne, Kilburn, Tyburn, Marylebone, Moorfields, Greenwich Palace, Palace of Westminster, Whitehall Palace, Custom House Stairs, Swan Stairs, Fishmonger's Hall. The common denominator? The Thames. The Mississippi drains a continent. Small beer, really. The Thames drains time itself. It's entirely appropriate that Greenwich, London's harbor town, should be the birthplace of time, and that Time's lighthouse, Big Ben, the most famous clock in the world, could be mistaken for a ship's lantern high up in a mast. The Thames, London. Notice the sequence. It's the correct one. The travel agent's brochures speak of the Thames as London's river. Close, but no cigar. It's the other way round. London is the Thames town. No Thames, no London. It's as simple as that. The Thames was here before London. The Thames is the reason London is where it is. The Thames made London. Look at the 1572 Braun and Hogenberg map of London. Many of those same streets are there today, nearly 4.5 centuries later. To the south of St. Paul's, towards the river, there are only 3 streets running east to west. The other axis, the north-south axis, is a different story. There are 15 or so north-south streets, a ratio of 5 to 1. What that tells us is that it wasn't so desperately important to be able to go east or west. And in any case, for that, you had London's largest and most important street, the River Thames. What was vitally important was to be able to go north or south. And it's not the compass points that are important here. What's important is what lay to the south, the River Thames. London is oriented to its river. The point is underlined in every way by Thames Street. It's the biggest and most important of the east-west land streets between the river and the cathedral. It's closest to the river. It accompanies the river. And yes, it's still with us. You can walk it. It's been rechristened Upper Thames Street and Lower Thames Street, but it's essentially the same street. Okay, let's go down to the river. Get into the slipstream of history. If you lend an ear, what can you see? Let's start with the name itself, Thames. It's the second oldest place name in this country. Kent pipped it to the post. We don't know with any certainty where the name comes from or what precisely it means. Various explanations have flowed down to us from the dark backward and abysm of time, dark being the mot juste. Because whether it's Celtic or even older, Sanskrit is a possibility. Tem or Tame, the core of the name, is said to mean dark. It's the very adjective you'd use to describe the Thames today. Indeed, it's the very adjective that sounds the keynote of one of the most spellbinding overtures in English literature, the great opening scene of Conrad's Heart of Darkness. On a cruising yawl, lying at anchor in the Thames, the flood had made, the sea reach of the Thames stretched before us. A group of friends are taking their ease, chatting aimlessly in the fading light. Then they fall silent, as if, in the gloaming, they've sensed a presence far more deeply interfused. The spirit of the past was all about them. Hugh Marlowe, the tale's narrator, quietly, chillingly, he remarks, "And this also has been one of the dark places of the earth." He's talking about the Roman era and what it must have been like for the commander of a trireme or a young Roman citizen in a toga to come up this river. Imagine him here, the very end of the world, a sea the color of lead, a sky the color of smoke, sandbanks, marshes, forests, savages. Knowing that in coming up these waters, he had crossed a frontier, was heading into a wilderness, heading into a place where civilization's remit didn't reach, heading into the unknown. What we do know is that the Dark One wasn't always here. 750,000 years ago, its course lay several miles to the north, through the Vale of St. Albans. The event that redirected the Thames, diverted it to its present location, was a glacier, a sheet of ice 1 mile high. Was that important? Well, it bears repeating. No Thames, no London. So the most important event in London's history took place 750,000 years ago. And if that's not enough forever for you, try this for size. Just about every London street is 40 to 70 million years old. That's how long ago London's clay was laid down, the clay that for centuries has been quarried for the bricks that are the baseline of London's domestic architecture. Indeed, the Thames foreshore is red with the stuff to this day, in the shape of discarded medieval roof tiles. Shall we get that timeline into perspective? There are 3.2 million houses in London. An average size London house, 2 to 3 bedrooms, semi-detached, will run to about 8,000 bricks. That's 25 billion bricks in London. One way to keep track of 70 million years is to make a brick a day. At that rate, you will have enough bricks for London, all 25 billion of them, in 70 million years. And that's what I was after. I love that little bit of calculation. I was really, really lucky with that. It just worked out beautifully. Okay, bedtime.